Over the past several years, we've witnessed many of the things which we regard as American institutions to become endangered. Slowly but inexorably, they're being taken away or sold off, or worse yet, killed off. It's a fairly long list of things, among them the First Amendment and the separation of church and state. And sometimes I wonder what is worse, that we have to mourn the loss of those institutions or that we have to live with ourselves after so easily letting them slip away. When I worry about how perilous our situation is, and when I fear that in the next 4 years it could only get worse, I am deeply grateful that the poetry of Philip Levine exists. And I am reminded that he is himself an American institution. And I like to indulge in the fantasy that he is at least one American institution which the powers that be will never go after, because they are afraid of him, afraid of the truths he tells, afraid of his compassion, and afraid of the just rage which so animates his poems. The America which Philip Levine speaks for is the other America, the authentic America, the one you won't see in the delusional claptrap of our president's campaign commercials. It is often a bittersweet place of inequality, of festering injustices, and of class and racial divisions which run deeper than any of us would care to admit. And for Levine, our understanding of what matters in America often comes too late, and thus his poetry is suffused with elegy. But Levine's America is also a place of wonder and astonishment, and it has room for every sort of eccentric, outcast, and hopeless dreamer aching for the big score. A weird and tragic, but genuinely inclusive society, such as the one that Whitman envisioned, and Hart Crane, and William Carlos Williams. Philip Levine is the principal living heir to that great triad of poets. Their heir not just because he shares their vision for this country, but also because he shares their music, their absolute faith in the richness of the American vernacular. He has been an important presence in American poetry for over 40 years now, and the example he has set for poets of subsequent generations, both as a writer and as a teacher of writing, has been an extraordinary one. He has published 18 books of poetry and a memoir, and he has translated the work of a number of important Latin American and Spanish poets. He has won just about every award available to an American poet, among them the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Lenore Marshall Prize, the Ruth Lilly Prize, as well as various fellowships. And he is one of those exceedingly rare poets whose testimony gets deeper and richer with every one of his books, and his new collection, Breath, is one of his very best. There's an exquisite poem in the new book entitled Keats in California, in which he talks about first reading Keats when he was 20 and then going out to wander the streets of Detroit under a gray soiled sky. It's the Detroit we all know very well from his poems. But in the poem, he also gives us a glimpse of himself reading Keats at the age of 70, reading Keats as if for the first time at the age of 70. The poem contains one of those meetings which abound in Levine's poems, in which the past and the present commingle, in which who we are and the histories and traditions which have fashioned us become one incandescent whole. In such visionary moments, those moments which Crane calls intrinsic myth, he speaks for both Philip Levine and for all of us who dwell in the other America. And here's how the poem ends. Before dark, I'll feel the lassitude enter first my arms and legs and spread like water toward the deep organs. I'll lie in my bed hearing the quail bark as they scurry from cover to cover in their restless searching for sustenance. This place can break your heart. It's a pleasure and an honor to welcome Philip Levine.
Okay, let's have dinner. Thank you, David. That was such a generous... are you reviewing these days? That was such a generous introduction. He said what I would have said, about the current situation, so I won't belabor you except to say that I'm going to commit suicide by voting for George Bush. No, I wouldn't. I would probably vote for Mussolini first. He had a sense of humor. For example, when he met Ezra Pound, he turned to his son-in-law, Count Ciano, and said, "Where did you find this idiot?" And Ezra couldn't understand him. Ezra thought his Italian was perfect, but... Well, I will read from my new book, and I thought I'd start out by reading from my previous book, The Mercy. I want to read a poem called Smoke. I want to read a Detroit poem. It's not that old, really, but that represents the city that I knew and loved and hated when I lived there. I lived there 26 years. Smoke. Can you imagine the air filled with smoke? It was. The city was vanishing before noon. Or was it earlier than that? I can't say, because the light came from nowhere and went nowhere. This was years ago, before you were born, before your parents met in a bus station downtown. She'd come on Friday after work, all the way from Toledo, and he'd dressed in his only suit. Back then, we called this a date, sometimes a blind date, though they'd written back and forth for weeks. What actually took place is now lost. It's become part of the mythology of a family, the stories told by children around the dinner table. No, they aren't dead. They're just treated that way, as objects turn one way and then another to catch the light. The light overflowing with smoke. Go back to the beginning, you insist. Why is the air filled with smoke? Simple. We had work. Work was something that thrived on fire, that without fire couldn't catch its breath or hang on for life. We came out into the morning air. Bernie, Stosh, Williams, and I. It was late March. A new war was starting up in Asia, or closer to home, one that meant to kill us. But for a moment, the air held still and the gray poplars and elms undoing their branches. I understood the moon for the very first time, why it came and went, why it wasn't there that day to greet the four of us. Before the bus came, a small black bird settled on the curb, fearless or hurt, and turned its beak up as though questioning the day. A baby crow, someone said. Your father knelt down on the wet cement, his lunchbox balanced on one knee, and stared quietly for a long time. A grackle, far from home, he said. One of the four of us mentioned tenderness, a word I wasn't used to, so it wasn't me. The bus must have arrived. I'm not there today. The windows were soiled. We swayed this way and that over the railroad tracks across Woodward Avenue, heading west, just like the sun, hidden in smoke. There's a curious poem in this book that I want to read to you, because it's really about someone who lived in this town. He lived here, and a lot of you knew him, but you wouldn't know it was him because I make him Italian, which he wasn't, and I make him an Italian poet. I make him Cesare Pavese. But I never knew Cesare Pavese. I knew this guy. But I read both of them. I read everything they wrote. It was easier for me to write about Cesare Pavese than it was to write about this other man, because this other man was close to my heart. So I wrote about Cesare Pavese and said what I wanted to say about the other man. That's the way poems are born. Or die. I mean, you never know whether it's a poem or not. Cesare. I don't know if you know Pavese's work. If you don't, you should find it. It's fantastic. It's just come out in a new translation by a guy named Jeffrey Brock, published by Copper Canyon. Thank you. Cesare. One sorry town after another passed the streaked windows of the train. We smoked, talked of growing up, he near Torino, I in Michigan. Born in a small town in an inland valley, he loved the sea, just walking along the shore day or night, filled with a joy he'd never known. In my imagination, even in the rain, with his wool cap pulled down over one eye, he passes the window of the cafe like a ghost as the day fails. I see him coming toward me now, tall, thin, myopic, full of delight in his awkward body, still only a boy with a boy's wide smile as the rain streams down. You too must know men like Cesare, still so young, brilliant, full of plans and tall tales. Then women enter their lives and the unfillable need for tenderness. They fall in love, then fall in love again and again, and nothing comes of it but heartbreak. And they are men. So when you reach to touch them, to help them, they turn away, because men must do that. Of course, I never knew any Cesare. He died before I left Detroit, before I had a chance. I'm really talking about someone else I can't name because I simply can't. A man so singular that when I lost him, I had the train ride I couldn't forget. Paris to somewhere in early fall. The towns along the way with their blackened churches, factories, shops, cinemas, all closed down. How did I miss what was to come? It was all there in the rain. I'm very pleased with this new book of mine. I know you, I really like it. I like the way it looks. I mean, I found the photograph. They didn't like the title. They said, no, the title's no good. I said, well, you think about it for a while. They weren't crazy about the photograph. I said, well, you'll get to like it. And sure enough, it happened. I mean, I was patient and stubborn. That's my nature, patient and stubborn. I lived through Nixon. I lived through Reagan. I mean, I was born, Herbert Hoover was the president. I survived that shit, you know. I'll get through this son of a bitch. You have to be patient and stubborn. You get your chance. Or you won't. But you certainly won't get it unless you stay around. This is called gospel. I live about 7 months a year in Fresno, California. What kind of a town is Fresno? It's not dissimilar from this one. Except it wasn't the capital of anything, not even California, much less the Confederacy. About half the people there come from Oklahoma and Arkansas, and they now think they're Americans. So, you know, they have two Buicks and an SUV, and they rent dirty movies. You know, I mean, it's the whole American thing, you know. DVDs, yeah, they rent DVDs. They have computers. Anyway, there are mountains near there, the Sierra Nevadas, and they're fantastic. They're not Republican. Gospel. the new grass rising in the hills, the cows loitering in the morning chill, a dozen or more old browns hidden in the shadows of the cottonwoods beside the stream bed. I go higher to where the road gives up and there's only a faint path strewn with lupin between the mountain oaks. I don't ask myself what I'm looking for. I didn't come for answers to a place like this. I came to walk on the earth, still cold, still silent, still ungiving, I've said to myself, although it greets me with last year's dead thistles and this year's hard spines, early blooming wild onions, the curling remains of spider's claw. What did I bring to the dance? In my back pocket, a crushed letter from a woman I've never met, bearing bad news I can do nothing about. So I wander these woods, half sightless, while a west wind picks up in the trees clustered above. The pines make a music like no other, rising and falling like a distant surf at night that calms the darkness before first light. Suffing, we call it, from Old English, no less. How weightless words are when nothing will do. This is called Absolute Water. It's amazing how well they can imitate the flavor of water with a little chlorine and that stuff for your teeth to poison your precious bodily fluids. I mean, we are living in Dr. Strangelove. You remember the guy in Dr. Strangelove? He's now the president. General somebody or other. I want to read a poem about my brother, if my brother were somebody other than my brother. It's called My Brother Antonio the Baker. The Canfield Station is just a police station. The expression I use for what they feed you in the drunk tank is the expression the police use. How do I know? I read it in the paper. The Duero is a river in Spain. My brother is having an infatuation, a sort of little love affair with the poet Antonio Machado. And so he likes to pretend he can talk the way Machado writes, which is okay. This is all in the poem. I don't think it happens that often in daily life. My brother Antonio the Baker. Did the wind blow that night? When did it not? I'd ask you if you hadn't gone underground lugging the answer with you. 28 years old on our way home after a 12-hour shift baking Wonder Bread for the sleeping prisoners in the drunk tank at the Canfield Station, dreaming of a breakfast of horsecock and mattress stuffing. Oh, the luxuries of 1955. How fully we lived, the working classes and the law-abiding dregs, on buttered toast and grilled cheese sandwiches, as the nation braced itself for pâté and pasta. To myself, I smell like a new mother, minus the aura of talcum and the airborne acrid aromas of cotton diapers. Today, I be labeled nurturing and bountiful instead of vegetal and weird. A blurred moon was out. We both saw it. I know because leaning back, eyes closed on a ruined sky, you did your thing, welcoming the bright orb waning in the west. Moon that rained down its silver coins on the darkened Duero and the sleeping fields of Soria. That's my brother. Did I look like you? My face anonymous and pure, bleached with flour, my eyes glistening with the power of neon light or self-love. Two grown men side by side, one babbling joyfully to the universe that couldn't care less, while the other practiced for middle age. A single crow settled on the boiler above the Chinese restaurant, his feathers riffling, and I took it for a sign. A second sign was the couple exiting the all-night pharmacy. The man came first through the glass door, a small white sack in hand, and let the door swing shut. Then she appeared, one hand covering her eyes to keep the moonlight at bay. They stood not talking while he looked first left, then right, then left again as flakes of darkness sifted upward toward the streetlight. The place began to rumble as though this were the end. You spoke again, only this time you described someone humble, walking alone in darkness. I could see the streetcar turning off Joy Road, swaying down the tracks toward us, its windows on fire. There must have been a wind, a west wind. What else could have blown the aura of Forsythia through the town and materialized one crosstown streetcar never before on time? A spring wind, freighted with hope. I remember thinking that at last you might shut up. An old woman stood to give you her seat as though you were angelic or pregnant. When her eyes spilled over with happiness, I saw she took your words to heart as I never could. Maybe she recalled the Duero, the fields asleep in moonlight. Maybe the words were music to her, original and whole, words that took her home to Soria or Krakow or wherever. Maybe she was not an old woman at all, but an oracle in drag who saw you as you were and saw, too, you couldn't last the night. I had the good fortune to go to college at a time when the American political spectrum was very broad. The John Birch Society didn't exist, but there were people there who yearned for it. And are, if alive, are probably quite gleeful. I think they were too mean to stay this long on Earth, though. And then over on the left, we had Trotskyites, Stalinists, anarchists, the whole schmear. It was great. You had Democrats and Republicans. You had everything. And it was kind of wonderful because we used to meet in these big rooms and have debates on serious subjects like socialized medicine or assassination or sedition. And we'd get very excited about it. And I wrote this poem in celebration of three people who entered the poem. I don't know what became of them. It's called Our Reds, R-E-D-S, Our Reds. Now, I give two of them pseudonyms. I don't know if many of you remember Ida Lupino. She was a film star, an unusual film star, because she wasn't beautiful. But she was unbelievably appealing. I remember years and years after I saw her, after she was dead, my wife and I went to dinner with her husband, her first husband, and his new wife. And I said to my wife, I want to ask him about Ida Lupino. She said, you don't dare. And I said, my brother and his wife were also there. I don't know people like this. He was a movie star, but Howard Duff, that was his name. God rest his soul, a sweet drunkard. And a terrific guy. And I said, but I've always been so fascinated by Ida Lupino. She used to play waitresses in movies. They used to make movies about waitresses, you know, in dumps. And she, you had the feeling she was a waitress in a dump. I mean, she just was so authentic. And not, you know, not powdered and not, and they didn't have to grease the lens or anything. They just, And she was also the first woman director in Hollywood. She directed some movies about waitresses, of course. We sat down to dinner. My wife sat next to Howard. Within 2 minutes, I hear Ida Lupino mentioned. My wife said, "You don't dare ask." She got carried away by the curiosity. What was she like? And Howard said, "I should have listened to my dog. He hated her." Then he had another drink. Our Reds. Let us bless the three wild Reds of our school days. Bless how easily Gaunt Vallejo would lose control, the blood rushing to his depleted face, while his mistress in a torn trench coat stroked his padded shoulders to calm him. We'll call him Vallejo after the poet, only because he vaulted into speech in such a headlong rush. In truth, he was Slovakian. We'll call her Lupino after the film star, because she was more beautiful in memory than in fact. Her cheeks drawn over fine bones, her hair tumbling down from under the beret, hair we loved and called dirty blonde. Vallejo would rise in class unasked to interrupt the tired fascist swill the stunned professor was giving out. Quote, "The proper function of a teacher is to inform the unformed cadres of the exploited classes regarding the nature of their enslavement to an estate sold to the masters of the means of production." End quote. Lupino would rise quietly beside him to show solidarity and to begin her therapy. Two-ton Cohen would join in, flashing his party cards for all to see and invoking the sacred triads of Hegel. And we, the unformed and the uninformed, dropped our pencils and groaned with gladness to be quit of Aristotle's ethics or the monetary theories of James K. Polk, and stared into a future of rotund potential fulfilled. They are gone now, the three. Vallejo, Lupino, Cohen, into an America no one wanted, or something even worse. So bless their certainties, their fiery voices we so easily resisted, their tired eyes, their cheeks flushed with sudden blood. Bless their rhetoric, bless their zeal, bless their costumes and their cards. Bless their faith in us, especially that faith, that hideous innocence.